Amsterdam FM presenteert Springvossen.
Het komende uur kunt u luisteren naar een nieuwe aflevering van Springvossen. Mijn naam is Robert van Altena. Vandaag ben ik de gast bij Galerie Sleeuwen. Tegenover mij zit Ryan Christopher. Thank you, Ryan, that you want to have this talk with me.
It's a pleasure.
You're from England.
Yeah.
You did the ateliers.
Yeah.
You had your final show a few months ago.
Yes.
So we're going to have this conversation in English. Or something that sounds like it, in my case. And now you have a show at Sleeuwen Gallery.
Yes.
And there's some works familiar that I saw also in the ateliers. And you had this really huge studio on the ground floor.
Yeah.
Was that your studio during your period there?
No.
As well? Just for the presentation?
Yeah. I was right up the stairs where another artist had a studio, Annabelle. But yeah, for Offspring, I just had that big space, which isn't usually used as a studio, actually. It's an exhibition space, which everyone can sort of book out.
Okay, yeah, I only come there when there's a show,
yeah,
so I
yeah,
don't know.
You just see the, yeah.
How did you come to hear of the ateliers, by the way?
It was actually through a tutor at uni, and it wasn't something I've heard of before, but my tutor sort of, he was friends with another tutor there. So he said it was a really good institution, recommended it. And I was just looking for something to do after that, you know, would take me away from the UK for a while. So I think it was sort of perfect. Yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. Initially, I found it very strange to be somewhere very different culturally. And also the sort of ateliers is a very interesting place in that it's not really human scale. You're sort of thrown into the studio, which is made for a, you know, class of 30 students, and you're given that whole space for yourself. And so that was very strange. As a sort
the
of
building
shock.
Already
exactly.
Is extra human.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So getting used to that, and then sort of finding a pace. There was less nature, which I struggled with, but then, you know, ended up building a garden with a friend in the atelier's sort of courtyard. So sort of making it home gradually and feeling more at home in the studio. And then, it, you know, you start to, you know, you have the headspace to focus on making work, and then it's home.
Yes, so yeah, this headspace you took with you from Coventry
yeah.
to Amsterdam.
Yes, exactly.
But the surroundings are so different
yeah.
that the space in your head changes as well.
Exactly.
And there's an intensification,
yeah.
of course, because there's another language around you,
yeah.
apart from the English,
yeah,
and there's
exactly.
this institution.
Yeah.
And perhaps also the expectations not even surrounding you, but the expectations from within.
Yeah.
You being thrown in that situation.
That's true.
And what I always hear, it's almost a cliche, is that students, artists struggle for a period
yeah.
at the ateliers and at the yeah. Rijksacademie,
yeah.
etc. How was that for you?
I think my way of dealing with the struggle was to go out a lot. So I was sort of cycling out into nature, into Amsterdam Noord, you know, just cycling for hours in the countryside.
So that's how you got to know Durgerdam as well.
Exactly.
What I spoke to you about.
Exactly. Yeah.
Before.
Yeah.
Nice.
So that was my sort of way of coping, and that's what gave me a lot of life. And also having a community outside of ateliers really helped. And then I could sort of go there, you know, feeling a little bit more fresh, a little bit more connected to the world. And then I could focus on my work. But I really had to just, you know, figure that out.
Is there for you a direct connection between your environment and your work?
Very much so. Yeah, I think my work's very sensitive in how it responds to the space. So I found that when I was in my studio, all of the work that I was making was really responding to it, even in the sort of the tones that were there. So there's a lot of sort of greys and whites eventually. And that was because that was the environment of the studio. So I think I was adapting to it, but without realizing that that's what I was doing, till sort of reflecting after.
Was your studio here more of a separated, isolated box from the outside world?
Definitely, yeah. It's sort of often described as a monastery, the whole of Atelier's, and even more so in that little, you know, in the studio. And the fact that there are walls separating you from your peers, and you're just sort of confronted with yourself and your work, and it's staring in you in the face every day. It's very confronting and isolating. Right. So I think that's where a lot of people find the struggle, especially sort of coming out of art school, where your peers are very close to you and you're sort of looking over your shoulder and seeing what everyone's working on. And then it's suddenly, you know, what are you working on? What are you thinking? And that's what all the tutors are asking you. So it's very confronting.
How did you cope? Do you have a strategy, or is it sort of natural way of dealing with it?
I don't think I ever really figured it out. It was always quite a struggle. And so I think it became a thing of really trying to get out of myself in my work. And so sort of the work becoming more universal or more anonymous, less of my hand in the work itself as a way of escaping that. So I guess the work became less tied to myself and my ability to create. So less sort of virtuoso, you know, this is the artist and this is what the artist can make with their hands, but more of sort of bringing in other materials, found materials, bringing in other voices, other narratives that had less to do with me, but still sort of reflected my interest in a sense.
So how would you work before the ateliers to get an idea? Because all the work I know is the work that's shown here at Sleeuwen.
Yeah.
Under the title Ecloque Saint Perpetua.
Yeah.
And your show at the ateliers a few months ago.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of an overlap. So was there a complete different way of working before in England?
It wasn't completely different, but there was definitely, I was using a lot more figures. So I was using images of people. Essentially, it was a lot more sort of maximalist in the amount of information that the works had. They were less refined and they were sort of more expressive in a sense. Less economical in the way that my works are now.
Was it painting?
I started painting. And for me, that was incredibly intense because of the amount of emotion that would go into the painting. And, you know, sort of every single brushstroke was very sensitive. And I found that really confronting and intense in that the amount of decisions that you had to make on that one canvas, that one frame, you know, that was overwhelming. So I think a big shift in my practice, especially coming to ateliers, was less decisions in the work, more sort of intuition, less of my own hand, which would also mean less of my own decisions that would be sensitive in you know, sculpting something or painting something and drawing. So
so is it then that the intuition, the space that you give to intuition, that you enlarge, the space that you enlarge, is at the same time also briefer because it's more based on choice.
Yeah.
Choice of material that you find, that you combine.
Yeah.
There's less intervention in matter.
Yeah, exactly.
In shaping it and figuring it.
So sort of working with what's there as much as possible. Yeah.
Does it create for you also a certain mental but also rational distance?
I think so. Yeah. I think I find that for me, it's a sort of comfort thing. I find that having parameters that I can work within, having a sort of structure that's there and it's fixed, that sort of allows me to focus on more of the nuances in the work and less about, you know, sort of overwhelming emotions. And so within this structure, what can I do? So in a sense, it's similar to painting, you know, when you have a canvas and you're, in a sense, your puzzle is that canvas and your questions are all directed towards that canvas. But for me, it's that canvas sort of becomes the space, and then that's what I'm working within. But I find that I'm very sort of strict in terms of what I'm thinking about and what I'm allowing myself to do forms. And
So painting for you was also a sort of recipient for all kinds of emotions that you carried with you, but also emotions that were caused by the act of painting.
Exactly, yeah.
And did you try to steer that so you could concentrate on a certain emotion? And was that the struggle?
I think it was, yes, in a sense. It was...
If you say in a sense, I'm sure you say it's not quite true.
Not quite. Yeah. But I think it was, I still want the sort of myriad of emotions, and I still want these sort of grand emotions, but then it's the form that they would take and the distance that they would have to the form of the work. So I find with some of the works that I have in the show with the masking tape, that's a sort of grand narrative, and there's these strong emotions, this sort of ecstasy and also great sorrow. So all of these grand emotions can be in a work that's, you know, on an inkjet print, on stuck to the wall quite nonchalantly with masking tape. And so for me, if I was to paint that, it would be grand. It would be like a Giotto or like a Veronese or like a Poussin. It would be very sort of poetic and colourful, and there'd be lots of life in it. But then for me, I was sort of interested in stripping back and refining that emotion and putting it into a form that's more sort of manageable for me, or, you know, putting it into a structure that I feel comfortable with.
Yeah, so that's perhaps a good introduction to look closer at your work, because what you're describing are two textual works. So there's one in the opening of the show when you enter the gallery on the right-hand side, and there's one in the second passage from the right space to the left.
Yeah.
There are two cloth floor works, one rectangular that you showed also at Ateliers, which is called Eclogue Intermediaries. And that's the rectangular one. It's discolored blinds, three of them.
Yeah.
And it's sort of triptych, lying down as well, with grays and broken white. There's another one, and that one is called Rue Herb of Grace.
Yeah.
Intermediaries.
Yeah.
And that one, it's also a sort of blind, isn't it? Or
yeah,
not?
It is.
And
blind.
And it's laid out circular. So it looks like a dress laid out, or like the robe of a dervish dancer, like doing this pirouette.
Yeah.
Right? But so there's a sort of dynamic, and at the same time, it's still.
Yeah.
And then there are two works that, that's, or one work that repeats itself. Right? And then these are cheesecloth satyrs. One, I'll get to ask you about the titles and about the story that lies behind it, of course. And there's a few works that are from, how would you call it in English? What is it? Plasterboard. I see it here on the listing.
Yeah.
Plasterboard with plastic. But it's a specific type of plastic. So one is called, one series is called Wind, and that has a plastic, which you call greenhouse covering, and there's grit on it. There's a really fine grit.
Yeah.
And I think that's this material that's semi-permeable. So one side it breathes, and the other side, the other side is étanche. What's the name? Doesn't let rain moist through. Yeah. Right? Something like that.
Yeah.
And the other ones are called wind. There's also one that's called rain and sunlight, and that has a transparent.
Yeah. Garden fleece on it.
Garden fleece on it.
Yeah.
And it works really nice, subtle, because of the wrinkles in the material. Really reduced in handling of matter. So these are portrait rectangulars.
Yeah.
Not small, not large either. You can really be in front of it. So it's an object, and at the same time it's image. But it's also because of your titles, because of the title overall of the show, they also get to be windows in the traditional sense that a painting can be a window.
Yeah.
And which is another way of saying that it's also a mental space, I think.
Yeah.
Or a poetic space.
Yeah.
Ryan. Eclogues sent perpetua. Eclogues, I heard of because I read my Virgil.
Yeah.
And it's the Bucolica.
Yeah.
And eclogues got to be another name for the same collection of poems. There are poems about shepherds, but a certain kind of shepherd, because it's written by a shepherd, but from the point of view of one who knows city life, who has enough riches to lead a life of leisure.
Yeah.
So there's this sort of Marie Antoinette view of being a shepherd.
Yes.
One might say.
Yes, exactly.
Right? It's a sort of, to put it anachronistically, otherwise, it's romanticized vision of the shepherd life. But you and this eclogue, I looked up to see if there was something else behind, and it's really quite a generic word, which in the beginning just meant selection.
Yeah.
But in association, the grammarians that put it on the work of Virgil caused that in association with the poems of Virgil, it got to be like shepherd's poems.
Yeah.
Right? So, but then you connected with something else in your title, Semper Perpetua. Could you tell me about Semper Perpetua?
Oh, she's wonderful. She's a martyr who lived in third century. She died. And she's a sort of big figure in the early church, in that she wrote this diary about her martyrdom, about her sort of thoughts before dying, and about her visions, which I was really interested in. And she sort of chronicles that, all of these emotions that she felt. And it's very important because it's one of the earliest Christian writings, and it's written by this woman from Carthage, North Africa. And she was very defiant, very bold, and also very poetic and sort of mystical in a sense. So I was sort of interested in her as this figure that was also admired by other figures in the early church, who were well known. There was Tertullian. St. Augustine wrote a good few sermons celebrating her feast day in the church. So she's a sort of revered figure. And I found that these narratives were so sort of full of life and incredibly beautiful, but incredibly short and sort of concise in the way that they were documented. And so that initially just attracted me in how economical it was and how much emotion was contained in such a small document, and also how structural it was. It sort of had these three visions that she had. It was all laid out very sort of in a very orderly way, and I found that's drew me to the documents and to her as a figure, quite an sort of enigmatic figure as well.
Perhaps in such an orderly way because it was passed on and we don't have the original documents, I take it.
Yeah, yeah.
So we know of it through other sources.
Yes, and it was, there was also a redactor.
So it's a little like a pebble in the stream.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So in that sense, it's complex because it was sort of also added to and edited by a redactor who sort of included an account of what happened while she was in the amphitheatre being martyred, and what happened after. Sort of, there's a sort of passage encouraging people in the early church to sort of, you know, to learn from her martyrdom. And so it's sort of also used in that way as sort of, in a sense, as sort of church propaganda to document this heroic narrative of the
So we're at the beginning of the, what was it, the 3rd century?
Yeah, so it was the year 203.
Yeah, so it's under Septimus Severus.
Exactly. Yeah.
Who got to sit on the throne for a bit, because before him it was a bit of a mess after the emperor philosophers like Marc Aurelius.
Yeah.
And it's North Africa, today's Tunisia.
Yeah.
It's after the Punic War, so it's under Roman domain.
Yes.
And Christians aren't accepted broadly, so there are no doubt like periods of repression.
Yeah, yeah.
So she got to be a martyr, so now no doubt she died for her faith.
Yeah.
But could you expand on that? Because you make a work around it. So it's not just the text. I think it's also like this whole story that's important for you.
Yeah. And I think also given the context that you just gave, I found it very interesting in relation to the eclogue and how when Virgil was writing his eclogues, he was very much responding to the political situation, you know, the sort of assassination of Julius Caesar and then the sort of political turmoil that came after that. And so he was responding to it and using these shepherds as a, this is my interpretation anyway, as a sort of way out of that and a way to comment it on these political situation, away from the sort of the noise of it all. So I sort of related to that, and I also found a parallel in Perpetua's situation, the sort of this uproar, this you know, Septimus Severus, and the sort of precarity of that situation. But then for her, the sort of bucolic idyll was in heaven. It was sort of not on this earth. So I found that very interesting in that her escape as a writer, her sort of Arcadia, in a sense, was in the afterlife. So I found that really interesting, and that sort of brought me to her narrative in relation to the eclogue.
Yeah. So she died because of her faith, but was there an action, or was there just sort of arbitrary getting together a few Christians to sacrifice them?
No, this was a demonstration, you know, teach them a lesson. Exactly.
But was there an act on her part to be part of those people?
Yes.
To get
she was
caught?
Incredibly comfortable. She was a Roman noble woman. She was very comfortable, very well educated. Her father repeatedly encouraged her to just give the offer the sacrifice to the emperor, you know, honor the gods, and she refused to. And she even had an infant child.
To give a sign to abstain from her religion, which was Christian.
Yeah. So for her, it was just faith. And also it's quite poignant, you know, sort of walking into her death when she could have very easily escaped it just by offering a sacrifice. Yeah. So for her, it was this huge step, and having an infant son and having to leave this child and her family who were sort of begging her to just offer the sacrifice. She sort of made this decision and stood with these other Christians as well.
Yeah, there's this strange doubling of image because she had a young child with her, also in imprisonment.
Yeah.
But there was also with her her enslaved chaperone, how would you call it?
Yeah.
Who was pregnant.
Yes.
As an image.
Yeah.
That's also very strong, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. And Felicitas, she sort of, there's many images of her.
Her name is Felicita. Yeah.
Yeah, there's this sort of images of her standing with Felicitas in the amphitheater. And so in that sense, there's this sort of beautiful equality that came in their decision together that sort of, you know, puts them on a level playing field.
How did you get to know this story of St. Perpetua and Felicita?
Well, it was just for a few years, I've just been very interested in North African Christianity. So it started off, I think, first year of uni. I was reading a lot of St. Augustine, and I heard him mentioning her in some of his sermons as well. So I just became fascinated through Augustine, really. Yeah.
But then, so you also looked up her text.
Yes.
And there's a text concerning her and there's a text concerning Felicita. Am I right?
Satyrus.
Satyrus.
Yeah.
Okay, because they were part of our group.
Yeah.
And Satyrus was another figure that was rounded up as well.
Yes, exactly.
Could you perhaps read the Perpetua text?
Yeah. And I went up, and I saw a very great space. And in the midst was a shepherd, sitting, milking his sheep, and standing around in white were many thousands. And he called to me, and from the curd he had, from the milk, he gave me as it were a morsel. And I took it with joined hands and ate it up, and all that stood around said, Amen. And at the sound of that word I awoke, yet eating I know not what of sweet. And we understood that it was to be a passion, and we ceased henceforth to have any hope in this world.
Oh, I thought you were going to...
That was it.
Okay, so because it was printed out.
It spills over, exactly.
Okay, exactly. I'm sorry. Yeah. And that, as you already told before, but people perhaps didn't know what you were talking about, these phrases you cut up.
Yeah.
And you put them up with sort of painting, masking tape.
Yeah.
Very simple.
Yeah.
So, but it gets to be an image at the same time as well.
Yes.
A broken line, you could say.
Yeah.
So you have this fascination for this ancient figure. You have the smallest of texts you can think of. So there's a lot of space to think. Mm. You're an artist that makes plastic works. Mm. So how do you go about in joining your practice with this field of ideas that surround this ancient figure?
I think it's sort of deconstructing a narrative, in a sense, and deconstructing it through the objects. So with the masking tape works in themselves, they take up quite a lot of space. So thinking about the narrative spatially, how it inhabits the space, and what you're saying about the sort of broken line, you know, how that can also impact the way that you read it. But then there's also other pointers to the narrative within the works. So there's the works with the cheesecloths, and there's these... So there's sort of plaster works that are made in the same way that you'd make cheese using a cheesecloth. And so there's these forms that are inverted and placed in a line of four. And those works are sort of a reference both to the morsel of curd that was given to Perpetua in her vision and to the four angels that were in the vision of Satyrus. So there's these sort of ways of bringing in the narrative in a tangible way, but through the forms that are in the works. So for me, that's my way of thinking about the narrative. It's spatially how it inhabits the space and how it can also be fragmented in different objects.
What's very nice, I think, about your work as well is that these are very simple materials, all of them, or even simple objects that were past their lifespan already, and that you turned into material, but at the same time, with the slightest of interventions, just consisting of redistributing it in a certain simple form. And it's what's nice about it is that even without reading up on the story or listening to you telling about it, is that the work in itself suffices already. Because it's in this sort of tradition in post-minimalist work, visually, and so it's very concrete, with objet trouvé, because that's perhaps also the case with a sound work that's part of the show, and these are sounds of sheep carrying bells.
Yeah.
Do you call them bells as well?
Yes, exactly.
In English?
Yeah.
And so that's throughout.
Yeah.
You hear that throughout the show.
Yeah.
And these are concrete works. And in that, you already express what you said, there's this sensitivity and that you make a selection. And what's nice about it is that it gets this extra layer that you also want to share with us, a reading of a very old story.
Yeah.
And you give us that story very briefly.
Yeah.
So we don't get the dates, etc. It's not a lesson in church history.
Yeah.
Is it for you clear that you share the story with us as well? Because very often you have work and there's a story behind it and we don't see the story.
Yeah.
And you present it in such a way that the story gets a work and it gets to be a work in itself as well.
Yeah.
So in a sense, for you, it's not just the object and the image, but the words are very important as well.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And also the sort of the image that they can conjure in the viewer. And for me, it's sort of important to strip the narrative
back. The image
back.
Of the words.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so for me, it's sort of important to strip the narrative back, to leave space for subjectivity, for people to read into it in their own way. And for me, that's a way of the narrative entering into them and into their own sort of bank of imagery that they can draw on. And very simple images, so it's sort of refining the narrative to trees, to angels, to curd, you know, the things that conjure an image. So using that economy as a way of the work being sort of, in a sense, constructed within the viewer. And allowing space for that.
So, and that in combination with the title,
that is
Eclogues in Perpetua. So this juxtaposition already creates mental space because you're searching for a connection.
Yeah.
For a sort of harmonization between two things that don't seem to be fitting together.
Yeah.
And there's the titles.
Yeah.
As well. They're also very simple. Wind, rain and sunlight, and there's cheesecloth, and there's rue, herb of grace, and eclogue. And then I'm a bit of lost at the same time, but I can make an association. For example, with rue and herb of grace, I don't know the plant. I don't know if I ever saw it.
Yeah.
But I take it it's a plant, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's called the herb of grace. And yeah, then in connection, is it because of the name that you chose it?
It's because of the name, and also or because does it, appear? It appears in Hamlet, in Ophelia's monologue.
New text.
Yes. Another text. So this very poignant moment in Hamlet where she's handing out flowers and she hands out rue, herb of grace, and it's sort of it's sort of in old English culture, it's this sort of it's herb of grace, and you're supposed to wear it on Sundays, and it signifies sort of repentance and regret and also sort of forgiveness.
So is that where the term rueful comes from?
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
So it's based on
the plant. But I think it's maybe later than that. I think the plant was based on that, on rue.
Because they started to use the plant as a symbol?
Yes, and it was also used in sort of...
For regret?
Exactly.
And then...
Yeah, and it also has a very interesting history in the church. It was used to sort of sprinkle holy water to... cast away demons and to using these rituals in the church. So it's got this sort of very, I guess, this history that's very
sort
tied
to pagan element,
exactly,
in the Christian liturgy.
Yes, exactly. And I think Ophelia is a sort of signifier of that as well, you know, the sort of flowers and the way she died, the way she drowned herself in the water. It's a very sort of romantic image, which sort of a lot of the pre-Raphaelites were obsessed with, this sort of romantic figure of melancholy, in a sense. So it's sort of bringing that into the work, but in a very subtle way,
yeah,
which was sort of alive for me. But, you know, other people might not pick up on it, but that's fine.
Are you an avid reader?
I do like to read, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because it's very nice how literature, but also... the reading, so interpretation,
yeah,
gets to be mixed with object and image,
yeah,
in your work. It's very natural, and you've got a very light hand. And that's perhaps also what you said, that the sensitivity of each touch with the brush could be overwhelming.
Yeah.
In the repetition of acts and in the observation of being absorbed in making a work.
Yeah.
And now it's completely simplified, isn't it?
Yeah.
You seem to distribute it over different works and different materials.
Yeah.
Is that a choice that you make beforehand? Or is that something that comes about?
I think it comes about quite naturally when I'm making, and the sort of process of making is always very intuitive, but then there's always the ideas and the poetic notions that are lingering around, and they sort of naturally permeate into the works because they're just a part of what I'm thinking about.
Yeah, because what's nice is also, and which is quite brutal, you could say even. And brutal is not a word that you would use for your work, but there's this huge contrast. Because what you use is materials and objects that are there either for decoration, like the blinds,
yeah,
which is already like a sort of passage,
yeah,
between inside, outside, showing and covering.
Yeah.
Which is already very close to your work in a sense.
Yeah.
But your work is also, what's nice, that it's not hermetic.
Yeah.
When you would see it, and people could judge you that way, but being there, very slight, because it's so sensitive, it doesn't get to be hermetic.
Mm.
But at the same time, is also this huge contrast because you use materials that are used in construction.
Yeah.
So it's really matter.
Yeah.
that we create something with in the here and now, that something that protects us from weather.
Yeah.
And with you, it gets to be the recipient and the representative of literature, history, thought, poetry.
Yeah.
And which is all very light.
Yeah.
Albeit very dramatic as well in the sense of the martyrdom.
Yeah.
But because it's so far away, it gets to be a thought and almost poetry.
Yeah.
Because I think that's also is something that you met, and that's why you bring it in contact with reference to Virgil.
Exactly.
But at the same time, it's something that you experience today, and because you, Ryan Christopher, experiences it today, it's alive and can be brought in contact with the matter that might protect us from weather today.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's something that keeps coming up in the work about the sort of protective covering and this sort of notion of providence. And for this show, it sort of comes up in the greenhouse cover and the garden fleece and this idea of covering. And even with the title of the sound work, it's called cloche, which in French is bell. And of course, it relates to the sound of the sheep bells, but it's also in England, in gardening, we sort of use it as a protective covering for plants in the same way that you'd use a garden fleece. Though we also use the word cloche to refer to that. So it's again this sort of idea of protecting, and that again links to the nature of the materials, a very sort of brutal, some used in construction, but always dealing with a human and a sort of separation from potential harm. This idea of, you know, providence being a separation and a connection in a sense.
But there's also, I can't help myself, and I wasn't brought up religious at all, but it's also that these plasterboards, they're constructive material for covering in isolation, but they're held together with almost paper.
Yeah.
And this needs to be protected.
Yeah.
So hence the plastic foil. Because were it not so, it would be dissolved by weather.
Yeah.
By wind and water.
Exactly.
And it would be dust again.
Yeah.
And that's the famous phrase above our graves.
Yeah.
Dust to dust.
Yes.
Right?
Yes,
so that's
exactly.
There's implicit in these works also this dissolving of life and matter in, let's call it, eternity.
Yeah, exactly. That's the sort of poignant element.
Yeah, that's very elementary.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
What surprises me is how much air you give the work. Because this reduction of materials and the subject matter might also be so particular that it's completely reduced to your own world.
Yeah.
Do you ever think of how you would communicate it with me through the work? Do you think about your public, how things are brought forth?
I think a lot about that. I think it's very important in that I work in fragments, so I'm very much aware that I myself, as a viewer to the work, I would only experience the work in fragments in the same way that you would experience it in fragments. So it's this sort of acceptance of the work that no one's going to get a whole picture of the substance that's in the work, but we'll all sort of experience it in very fragmented ways, and that's sort of enough because that's the nature of the work itself. And so, yeah, this is sort of leaving a sort of openness for poetry. And I really like something I read a few years ago, which really impacted me, in some notes on cinematography from Robert Bresson.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Yes.
Everybody should read that.
Yes.
Note en cinématographe. I don't know if it was translated in Dutch. Apparently it was in English.
Yes. Yeah. So reading that quite early on, and Bresson speaking about finding poetry within the gaps, within the sort of crevices of your structure in your making, within the form that you're dealing with, and the poetry not directly being sought after, but sort of seeping through and permeating something in a subtle way. And so for me, those gaps are space. They correspond to space. They correspond to me not saying something, but leaving a void for someone to fill in. And that's when it's sort of filled with their own poetry. And for me, that's where the real sort of substance of the work comes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you don't make poetry, but you create the situation in order for poetry to come alive.
Exactly.
And that's also exactly how Robert Bresson works in his films.
Yes.
So because his films are always very simple, very concrete, focused on the act.
Yeah.
So there's this film by him, it's called Argent.
Yeah.
And it's all about the transaction of money all the time.
Yes.
But focusing on that as a filmmaker, he creates a whole story about our society. So bigger, transgressing the situation of the individuals, the characters that are put in front of us.
Exactly.
And that's also how it works with your work. But seeing that, reading that with Robert Bresson is one thing.
Yeah.
Recognizing it is another.
Yeah.
Using it in your own work is yet something else.
Yeah.
Your work doesn't show sweat and tears.
Yeah.
But they must be behind there somewhere. So this gap isn't just there because you left it open. The gap that's there in order to for poetry to come alive was created by you.
Yeah.
It's the part of the show that's not visually, concretely, materially there was also created by you. But does it come just like that?
I think it's something that has sort of permeated me in myself, in how I deal with things. Other writers that I read have a similar approach. The sort of Soren Kierkegaard has this way of writing where it is very much about the gaps, and not about his opinions, but about writing as an aid to self-reflection, sort of allowing space for subjectivity. And that in Bresson's work is core. And so for me, it came very naturally to take up that sensibility and to translate it into the works, in that I don't want the works to be about my own voice, but I want it to be a void of my own voice, so that it could be filled with someone else's. And I think that's a similar thing that they wanted, and that they wanted to sort of get out of themselves in a sense, or to provoke poetry in other people, or provoke thought or emotion in other people. And I think that's something that I naturally sort of picked up.
A rare thing.
Yeah.
And what's nice about it always is that in the end, It gives also a portrait of Kierkegaard, of Bresson, and of Ryan Christopher as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the little time we spent together, a quarter an hour yesterday, and now during this conversation and the 10 minutes leading up to this conversation, gives me this impression that your work is also inevitably, one might say, this portrait of the artist sitting in front of me, the person sitting in front of me, which is always a very good sign.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you are in the awkward situation that you don't get to rhyme the person and the work.
Yeah.
And you, at a very young age, for an artist, have that. That's quite something, I must say. Yeah.
Thank you.
So, this is your first show in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Did you do...
Well, second in Amsterdam, but first solo.
But the first gallery show.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, did you do more gallery shows?
I did like one solo? Other in London. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you like making shows?
I have mixed emotions about the making. They sort of... I enjoy after being able to sort of experience my own work, but the sort of making is full of, again, being confronted with decisions, which is difficult.
Yeah. And but, sort of a lot of doubt. Which is very nice as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. When things start to work, it feels amazing.
Because you really, because then you have this disgusting work of the hard thinking, I think.
Yeah.
Which is disgusting when it's really taking up everything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's very consuming.
That's how I can experience it. I don't want to project it on you, but that's how I experience it.
It really consumes.
But at the same time, you know that it's very fulfilling.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you don't get to experience the fulfillment because you're in the middle of it.
Exactly. You've got to have some time away, look at it with fresh eyes, and then it becomes alive again.
But it's necessary at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you get to express yourself sharper, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. It's important.
Do you experience it like that? That a presentation like the Atelier and here is a sort of marking in your practice?
I think so. I think it's a way of documenting where I'm at, where my inner life is at, where my thoughts are at. And it's very important in this space as well, in terms of through a gallery, how this whole show came about and the sort of subtlety of the relations that brought about this turn of events. I think they're as much a part of it as anything else. Yeah.
Do you write?
Not much. I used to write, but my writing now is usually taking notes every day, sort of journaling.
Yeah, so sort of the concreteness of the matter that you work with.
Exactly.
And the words get to be an equivalent of that.
Exactly. And everything, I think I read a lot more than I write. So it's always reading, but then distilling what I'm reading into notes. So everything is sort of refined in terms of how I process knowledge and, the same process with making work.
Yeah, but there's language in your work. Not just the language works, but there's language permeating your work.
Yeah.
So so it's present, it's there.
Yeah.
And that's perhaps your way of working with language.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ryan, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been great.
For
Thank
this
you.
First conversation, I always say.
Yes.
it would be nice to continue it.
Yes.
Yeah. So your show, Eclogue, Sint-Perpetua, is on show at Sleeuwen Gallery until the 23rd of March.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.